Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
Deflected, intercepted. On the deflection, Blake Countess again.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. That's University of Michigan defensive back Blake Countess making his second interception against Notre Dame last Saturday. Michigan won 41-30. On campuses like Michigan and Notre Dame and many more, football is king. The celebrity coaches, the star players, marching bands, cheerleaders, huge stadiums, excitement. Investigative journalists Armin Katayan and Jeff Benedict go beyond the cheers to the story we kind of know but don't really know. Yes, there is glory and amazing athleticism, but also the details of sex, exploitation, broken bodies, and all that money. This hour on Point, inside the world of big-time college football. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Is this your autumn joy, your passion? What about the rough, seamy side? Is it okay to cheer and look away? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We are talking today to the authors of the big new book, The System, The Glory and Scandal of Big-Time College Football, Jeff Benedict and Armin Katayan. Joining me from Roanoke, Virginia, Jeff Benedict, special features contributor for Sports Illustrated, author of Pros and Cons and Out of Bounds. Jeff Benedict, thank you very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
And with us from New York, the celebrated Armin Katayan, CBS News correspondent, lead correspondent for 60 Minute Sports, 11-time Emmy Award winner. He is author of Money Players and Raw Recruits and a whole lot more. Armin Katayan, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having us.
I mean, here we are. It's the start of the season. Everybody's all excited. And suddenly here you guys are with this tremendous new book. I mean, you lay out so many details. Kind of in a theme we know, but who knew about all these nooks and crannies and the big picture? Same time Sports Illustrated's got a big series coming out. I mean, are you here to say shut it down, rain on the parade, or hooray with caveats? Or what's the big message here, Armin?
Well, I think the big message is that people see college football through a couple of prisms. One is television, and the other one is the in-game experience. And what Jeff and I worked so hard to do was to kind of pull back the curtain and to show not only the average fan and the rabid fan, but the uninformed person who likes sports, what's going on behind the scenes and all the component parts of the system that make up and produce the spectacle that you see on Saturday and Friday and Thursday and Tuesday and Wednesday. So that was the charge, and we tried to have each of the chapters be a specific part of the system that would tell you something that you didn't know. And Jeff and I worked so hard to get people that had never really talked before, were part of stories but had never really opened up. And that, I think, is as proud as we are of anything in the book, is to have voices that were part of the system that had never spoken out before.
The system speaking here in the book called The System. Jeff Benedict, you and Armin spent months and months on this, hundreds and hundreds of interviews, and you've said that the difference between the way you used to watch college football to now is like putting on 3D glasses. What do you see when you spend months in there that we might not see? I mean, we kind of think we know these things. We think we know them, Jeff. You know, yeah, recruiting can get kind of scuzzy, and academics, oh, come on, it's kind of a joke. We think we know these things. What did you find that we don't know?
Well, you think you know until you spend, months with a tutor who tutors student athletes, or with a hostess who escorts them when they come to campus as high school recruits, or with a teenager who's, in a city like Compton and has coaches who make millions of dollars a year come to his rough neighborhood and try to woo him to come to his university to play for 4 years. When you actually live in their life for a little while, which is what Armin and I have done for the last 18 months, Armin and I thought we knew a lot about college football until we worked on this book, because we've been doing this for 20 years. And I'll tell you that I know a lot more now than I did when we started.
What's wrong with tutors? I mean, that seems like a natural for college
athletes.
Yeah,
it seems so benign.
And what's wrong with hostesses? You're visiting the campus. What's the big deal, Jeff?
Go ahead,
well,
Jeff.
Tutor, I mean, they're obviously two separate things, but tutors are a requirement on every campus that has big-time sports. There's no way that guys who spend more time on athletics than in the class can get by without tutors, so you have to have them. The problem is most of the tutors are girls and the athletes are obviously guys. And when you put these guys in a room with these girls, they're tired, they're exhausted, they don't want to look at books, they want to look at girls. And some of the girls that are there for the wrong reason. And so you have this sexually charged environment. And the case that we document in the book is at the University of Missouri, where a tutor who was there for the right reasons ends up getting sexually assaulted by one of the players that she'd been tutoring. And it's a fairly graphic case, but it illustrates a problem that's not unique to Missouri. This is something that goes on campuses across the country. And so because of the demands on these student athletes, you have situations like this where the NCAA doesn't really have an ability to police or control this, and universities are sort of set up to have this unwanted sexually charged environment that puts some girls in really risky positions.
Is it risk? I mean, college, these are young people. It is sexually charged, right? Are you saying that they're putting pinup girl tutors out there as a reward or a payoff to these athletes? Is that your...
No, that's more the hostess side. The tutor side is most of the girls who get into tutoring are there because they need the job. They need the $7.50 an hour. They're smart. And they see this as a good way to earn money while they're in school. The players come in and, you know, they're not there to learn. A lot of them are just too tired to do that. They want to mess around. And so the girl who's there for the right reasons and who may be naive and not really aware of what some of these guys are thinking when they come into the tutoring center, those are the girls who I mean are at risk.
You've got one assault in Missouri. That's bad. But is that a college football black eye? Is it widespread problem?
I think it is a widespread problem because we certainly talk to tutors at South Carolina and at Miami and at other SEC schools mm-hmm. where you would have actual, to flip it around, what yeah. Jeff was saying, you would actually have at certain schools where the girls would willingly want to become tutors because they would be in close proximity to the star athletes, so they could then have a romantic relationship with them, which would then give them a higher status on campus. So this sexual street goes both ways. It's not necessarily a one-way look for the athletes. And as Jeff is going to talk about, and we can talk about the hostesses, it's an entirely different environment with a hostess who's there for really one reason, and that's to entice high school star athletes to commit to a certain school. And we document the case, and Jeff was fabulous in getting Lacey Earps, Pearl Earps, to speak about her experience at Tennessee with Lane Kiffin and how she was so much a part of the system and very, very successful in recruiting and delivering, in one case, the top recruit in the country, Bryce Brown, to Tennessee, and then how she was abandoned by the athletic department when times got tough and Lane Kiffin found himself in the middle of an NCAA investigation before he left to go to USC. So that's another very, very, as we've seen in the Oklahoma State story now coming out, this is kind of an unseen advantage and an unseen tool that the teams use very successfully, particularly in the SEC, to recruit top players.
Jeff, I mean, we know or heard the stories about envelopes of cash or maybe jobs. You guys write about those as well. We'll look at that. But you put front and center this sort of a sex as a way of getting the top recruits into a particular school, or at least sex appeal. Which is it? I mean, you've got Lacey Pearl Earps here, you know, with Tennessee's Orange Pride, known as the closer, and it wasn't because she was just well-spoken.
No, and, you know, Lacey does a great job of explaining that the girls were expected to use sex appeal to lure these players. And she makes a great point, which we really focus on in the book, is mm-hmm. you got to remember, the boys who are coming to campus as high school recruits are boys, not men. They're yep. 17 years old. Yep. They're juveniles. And they're being escorted for a weekend by college girls who are adults. It's like going on a date with a college girl. It's a pretty big deal for a high school kid.
And college girls chosen because they are very attractive.
because they're very attractive, and they basically are advertising what you'll get if you come here. And with the new social media of Twitter and Facebook and Skype, these girls will Skype and communicate with these boys till 4 in the morning after they've left campus and gone back home. They have this ongoing online digital relationship that is used to sort of entice them to think that if you come here, if you commit and come here, this is what you're going to get. You're going to get us. And that's kind of the difference maker sometimes when everything else is equal, the facilities, the Nike contracts, the television deals, because all these schools in the SEC, they all have that to offer. But the girls, these closers, they can be the difference. And the Tennessee case is big because it's the only one that really reached the attention of the NCAA. But the truth is, the NCAA didn't really scratch the surface on what was actually going on down in Tennessee.
I mean, automobile manufacturers put sexy girls in car ads. Is this so different from that?
Well, I think it's different because people didn't know what was going on. And I think that's one of the parts of the book, of the many parts of the book, is where you think you know something about college football, and then what we do is take you down three or four levels. Yeah. And sometimes we take you up three or four levels. I mean, we can, you know, there's a lot of positive in this book, and both Jeff and I talked about this very early on. We did not want to write an expose. We wanted to open people's eyes.
Play in regulation. Hill, as far as he can. Oppo makes the catch, and he's tackled inside the 30. Virginia holds on to win in its 2013 season opener.
BYU versus Virginia, a week and a half ago on ESPN. College football is big. Jeff Benedict and Armin Katayan write about it in a very big way in their new book, The System, The Glory and Scandal of Big-Time College Football. They are with us today. Armin from New York, Jeff Benedict from Roanoke, Virginia. A little more sound here, just to remind people who may not pay attention to this all the time of just how intense this stuff gets. Recruiting is a big, big deal. Here's number one high school recruit in the class of 2014, offensive tackle Cameron Robinson from Louisiana. Here's the announcement last week of his decision to go to the University of Alabama. Here from the Bleacher Report.
The biggest fish in the pond has been caught. Cameron Robinson, the number one overall player in the 247sports.com composite, has committed to an SEC school, LSU or Bama. In the end, it's Alabama. Nick Saban catches another big fish, reeling in the five-star, 6'5", 330-pounder from West Monroe, Louisiana. What does it mean for Alabama? Well, it means the rich keep on getting richer.
What happens when they're all in there? Well, a lot happens. Jeff Benedict and Armin Katayan write about it in The System. Part of what happens is a lot of damage to these young men's bodies. Here's a bit of University of Cincinnati quarterback and senior Munchie Lego crumpled to the ground during last Saturday's college big-time game after getting hit low while trying to pass. He is out for the rest of the season. Here's the play from ESPN.
Munchie Lego is down and holding his knee.
Now the whole team, for the most part, for the Bearcats, coming off the sideline in a show of support for one of their senior quarterbacks. So now somehow everyone has to refocus and get back to football. How hard is that going to be for the Bearcats as they lose one of their two senior quarterbacks?
And how hard for that young man, maybe for the rest of his life? Jeff Benedict, Armin Katayan writing about all of it. Sports Illustrated coming out with a big series at the same time, focused really on Oklahoma State. Here's athletic director there, Mike Holder, apologizing Tuesday in advance of that series about allegations of paying players, academic misconduct, drug use, luring recruits with sex.
We're all committed to playing by the rules, doing things the right way here, and for people to say that that's not what's happening is very disturbing.
Jeff, Armin, we've got callers for you. Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Roger's calling. Roger, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Really, this is the symptom of a larger illness, and it's a minor symptom. It's a minor symptom of the disease that's destroying the country. The gladiatorial spectacles of ancient Rome were distressing, but they were a minor symptom of the overall Roman culture, which was violent and aggressive and pagan. And that's basically what we have here. We have a society that worships money, that chews people up and spits them out. And most of the people who watch these college games would be perfectly happy to get that kind of money for the privilege of destroying themselves in the front of other people. I don't think that, I don't want to say this is a minor problem, but I'm saying it's probably one of the least problems we have, and it's symptomatic of a much broader problem.
But symptomatic of something very big. Roger, we've got it, and you're right there in Oklahoma where there's a lot of attention on all this right now. I don't know, Jeff, Armin, there's Roger going meta on us. You know, we're back at ancient Rome, violent, money-obsessed, wealth-obsessed, and college football is a symptom of it. Do you guys go that far?
I think college football. Go ahead, Jeff. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say this is different in numerous ways. I mean, we, for one thing, Armin mentioned television earlier in the program, and the fact is because of that, hundreds of millions of people can get in on this from the comfort of their living room. And so it provides you a distance from what's actually going on the field and in the locker room. Most people who watch college football really don't have a sense or a feel for what it's like to be those players and to give up your body for 4 years, knowing that more than 99% of them will never make a living doing this. And so I think there's sort of an insulation that most fans have from the game. And a lot of that is provided by television.
Armin, does that distance of television absolve us of kind of the responsibility of the spectator for what we're seeing? Or are we just as culpable as the ancient Roman in the Colosseum, you know, with the blood spurting on their toga?
Well, I think if they could have put the Roman spectacle on television back in those days, that would have worked out pretty well for the empire. And I think right now, the spectacle and what ESPN, which dominates college football from morning till night on Saturdays and on several other days of the week, they are going to spend more than $400 million. The network will spend more than $400 million in this new college football playoff to televise, for the rights to televise, the multimedia rights for three games.
Okay.
The two semifinal games and the final championship game.
And this is a new deal.
That tells you something.
New structure.
Pardon me?
A new deal, a new structure that they're...
A new structure and a new playoff system. So if we're talking about the spectacle, this spectacle is only going to get more spectacular and more pressure on the players. And I think the one thing that Jeff and I were so proud of the reporting, I think, that we did in one particular area. And Tom, you mentioned the injuries. We went out and compiled our own list of season-ending injuries last season. And it was, Jeff, what, 282?
282.
Season-ending. Bad enough that they were out for the whole shebang there.
And that was in the eight top BCS conferences and the major independents. And there was one particular month that we discovered in our research, October, where 35% of the season-ending injuries came in one single month because of the year-around demands that are asked of these players. It is really a full-time job with only about 3 weeks off the entire year. And now when you add a college football playoff and you add the increased pressure and the multiples of millions of dollars that are funneling into these conference television packages, you know, Mark Emmert said it himself. He said, the president of the NCAA said it, and I was in the room. He goes, I don't know where this is headed. I have no idea where this is headed.
So do you see exploitation or a road to glory or both here for these young guys?
Well, exploitation is a complicated term.
Well, if you're brought in, not paid, you know, taken when you're young and hungry for just to be up and out there, dream of the NFL, and you get your body beaten to bits right there in college – sounds exploitive.
It is to an extent, but you know, if you ask these players, and we've asked many of them, knowing all that, would you do it again? I've never heard one say no.
Wow. Yeah.
They all sign up. They want to do. There's something about the thrill and the charge of running onto a stadium with 80,000 people screaming, bands playing, cheerleaders jumping, television cameras rolling. There's very few boys in America that get to experience that thrill.
But who's playing these days, Jeff? Would you send your sons out there, put them on this path?
Well, fortunately, my sons are into music, and I'm glad they're not in the direction of football. No, I wouldn't want my sons to play this game. But there are a lot of boys who want to play this game, and there's a lot of parents who are fooled into thinking that, you know, if he plays, he may make it into the NFL. The numbers, you know, tell a very different story, but even knowing the numbers, I'll go back to the point that if you an informed player is still going to want to do it.
But is it like the U.S. military, where it's drawing so much of its numbers from kids who may not think they have a lot of alternatives, good alternatives?
No, I think what is happening right now is that the lifeblood of these $100 million businesses is built on the back of one thing, and the most precious commodity are the athletes themselves. And whether they're 18, 19, 20, 21 years old, this inverted pyramid with all the pressure and all the money that's involved is resting on the back of these kids. And one of the things that we do in the book is we talk about one of the top recruits in the country, Ricky Seals-Jones, who is now getting a lot of playing time, and you'll see him when Alabama plays A&M. He's a starting or playing a lot at wide receiver. He's 6'5", 225 pounds, from a great family out of Sealy, Texas, with a mother and father, very good people.
Yep.
But the father told me that he had offers, that certainly one on the table, that was $300,000, the use of a luxury suite, $1,000 for Ricky, $500 for the family.
This is from a college, and 300 grand to get them to come to him.
Yeah. And what Chester Jones told me was that he had other schools that were willing to double that offer to $600,000.
How would they pay that? How do you get away with that? I mean,
it's pretty easy. Let me tell you.
Yeah.
What you do is you get 10 boosters who are willing to give you $100,000 in cash that you put into a black box fund that is used by a recruiter or somebody on your staff or somebody with connections to your staff. And they go out and they pay for these players.
How do they do that, though? I mean, $300,000 or $600,000 to this young man or his family? They just is Swiss bank account or cash in a bag
cash,
or what?
Cash in a bag. It's not. There's no the one thing that has changed greatly in the last few years is the money now in college football, particularly into the players' hands, and particularly when it comes to upfront payments, move silently, and it's all in cash, and you're never going to find it.
And if they do find out, what's the penalty for that?
Well, you're looking at a long time on the NCAA's probation list if somebody comes up with it can prove that somebody actually gave you the money. But as we saw in the Johnny Manziel case, whether Johnny Manziel took money from those autograph dealers or not, the NCAA wasn't going to find it. It wasn't going to be in the Manziel's family's bank account. It certainly wasn't going to be in Johnny's bank account, and it wasn't going to be in anybody close to Johnny's bank account. And frankly, if anybody got paid, it was paid in cash.
$600,000 maybe. Jeff, I read you here saying the athletes in the pipeline are going to increasingly be the kids of parents who are less informed about the risks, because those aware of the risks will keep their kids out of football. It's going to be the lower-income kids in small pockets of the country, maybe people who wouldn't be have their head turned by $600,000, but if you got little, it's especially head-turning.
Well, there's much more public awareness these days than there ever has been about the risks of playing football, and that's largely because of concussions. That started in the NFL, but that awareness has quickly spread to college, and the college game has inherent risks too, and you don't have to make it to the pros to suffer brain injuries and other damages. Armin and I have a whole chapter in this book about that, about the wounded and about concussions and the impact it's had on college players. And I think campuses are more aware of this, college presidents, they know it. It's a scary thing. Because we see what it's done to the NFL in a huge class action lawsuit. But parents who are sitting at home are reading about this. They're seeing it on TV, and the hits that we're seeing on TV are becoming more and more violent because the players are faster, stronger, heavier, bigger. And, I think it does have an effect. It's not something you're going to see immediately, but over time, clearly, as people become more and more aware, it's sort of a big question mark on, where the future of this goes for the game.
Let's go to Sergi in New Orleans, Louisiana. Sergi, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom, and hello to your guests. Well, I'm calling, trying to be kind of an advocate for the students. I was a student tutor at LSU when I was in college.
Yeah.
And to be honest with you, what the guests are saying, probably with the ladies, maybe that's true, but I never found any of that to be true while I was a tutor. I tutored a couple of offensive linemen and players, and a lot of times the tutoring would take place in open spaces in a big room where students and athletes and college tutors interact, and it wasn't. I actually had more empathy for the students because I was of the opinion, maybe stereotypical in that way, that oh, college students, they probably will get away with anything. But these kids would show up after practices, after classes, after long flights, and they will still show up, and they will have to sign. And if they don't sign, they have to pay. They are held responsible, and they have to go to all these meetings and homeworks and all that. So they work hard. I mean, who in our right minds would go to college, work very excruciating physical activities in practicing, playing football, and coming to study? I mean, and yes, the injuries are right, but I also want to give credit to those, and many of them, maybe the star players are few and far between, and that's what carries the limelight, but many of them do study, and many of them have to pass to even go to classes.
Sergio, you're great, and I appreciate you, you know, telling it exactly as you saw it. I mean, Armin, you know, there's a different view. Look, there's hardworking tutors out there. There's hardworking young athletes out there. This is not easy, but they show up, and with surgery,
sure.
They
I
do
mean,
it.
They, absolutely. And we certainly don't make a blanket accusation that everybody is laying around on couches in, you know, academic facilities, you know, making out or engaging in sexual activities. I think what Jeff and I were certainly striving for is that there's nuances here and there's a different side to everybody sees these fine academic facilities that are built for basically one reason, to keep these players eligible so they can continue to perform on Saturday or Thursday night or whatever it is. And that's okay. But when you look at the demands, and I think this is kind of getting back to a more important point, and Sergey was making it, there is an enormous amount of physical, emotional, and mental demands that are put on these kids. And I think for me, the revelation of in almost 2 years of reporting was how important and how much sacrifice and how much sweat these players give to these 80, 90, and $100 million programs. Many of them, as we were saying, willingly, they would do it again. But they are not in any way, shape, or form normal students. They are athlete students, and they are special in the sense of their value, particularly A.J. McCarron, Denard Robinson last year at Michigan, Matt Barkley at USC, Jadeveon Clowney at South Carolina. There's a list of them now. Teddy Bridgewater at Louisville. These are incredibly valuable commodities to these schools that are worth tens of millions of dollars in ticket revenue and in television revenue. And as far as I'm concerned, they should be treated like kings. They should get as much food and as much help. And if they take money from a booster, I am so far past that. As far as an abuse of the system, because I think the system in many ways is abusing them.
I mean, you write about money, yes, maybe once in a while for a fancy car, but a lot of that money just for food, just to get by, maybe go to the movies. These are not rich kids very often. This is On Point. We'll be right back. UAB, LSU, just a few days ago, college ball, big-time college ball. Jeff Benedict and Armin Katayan write all about it, the glory and the underside in their big new book, The System, The Glory and Scandal of Big-Time College Football. There's an excerpt at our website. Check it out, onpointradio.org. Jeff Benedict, specials features contributor for Sports Illustrated. And, of course, Armin Katayan, CBS News correspondent, lead correspondent for CBS's 60 Minutes Sports, 11-time Emmy Award winner. They spent many months deep in this world. Everybody knows the big spectacle that draws so many eyeballs whenever the games are on. Everybody knows, in a way, that it's not all It's not all squeaky clean back screen, but they're really deep into what's actually going on. Jeff Armin, here's a couple of responses from listeners. Adam says, it should be a national embarrassment that in most states, the highest paid public employee is a football coach. We'll talk about that. Michelle says, I left a Division I school because the business of sports was sickening. No wonder our college costs are out of control. Tuitions are subsidizing athletes and fat salaries of coaches and athletic staff. What about the way that money flows here? How much money there is, and is it a net gain for these schools somehow or not?
You know, Tom, both those comments are true. And one of the cases we document in the book, which is pretty fascinating, is when Washington State, a public institution, wanted to hire a new football coach 2 years ago, and they turned to Mike Leach, who had been the head coach at Texas Tech and had been fired there. What they quickly discovered was in order to get him to come to Washington State, he was going to have to become the highest paid public official in the state of Washington. At the time, the highest paid official in the state of Washington was the football coach at the University of Washington, their chief rival.
Yeah.
And when he signed his contract and went to Washington State, millions of dollars, one of the first things that happened, it's actually one of the more humorous scenes in the book, is the human resources person came into the president's office at Washington State and said, we have a problem. What's the problem? Well, we can't process the check. Well, why not? Because our computer software doesn't handle these kinds of amounts. It's so much bigger than any salary we've ever had in the system. We can't even process its payment. And it was that was the signal to the president, you know, we finally entered big-time college football.
Let's get a call from Washington State, Seattle. Kathy's on the air, on the line. Hi, Kathy. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tom. I was an academic counselor at a regional university, and part of our job was to advise students on a class schedule. And the coach did not want us to do that because he had certain profs that were willing to give these kids good grades no matter what. And so he did not want us to advise them like we advised all other students. He wanted to cherry pick the courses for them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And another thing was he had invited me to come over and talk to some prospective incoming students and talk about academics, but basically he wanted me to sell the program. And so when I talked to them, I told the kids, you know, while you're here, take advantage of getting an education because your chances of playing football are so slim. And we had had one athlete that had made the pros, and they were really selling this. And I was never invited back to talk to students.
Welcome to the system, Kathy.
Yeah, welcome to the system. Is it a fair trade for these young men, Kathy, or not then? How do you end up feeling about it?
I felt they were used, and when they were done with their, you know, when they no longer could play for whatever reason, either they had aged out, then that they were on their own.
Yeah.
Hey, nobody gave a darn.
I appreciate your call from Washington State there. I mean, Armin, how do you see the people inside the system thinking about this? Because they know some will go to the pros and have big careers there, though that comes with its own risks and costs. Do they feel bad about kind of, you know, wringing some of these kids out, promising more than they're actually going to have? Or are they so deep in it that they're beyond thinking about that?
Well, I disagree to a certain degree because I spent a tremendous amount of time at the University of Alabama, and I was able to get what I would describe as on sort of unprecedented access inside Nick Saban's program,
yeah,
which has won two of the last three national championships. It's the number one ranked team in the country this year. Nick is by far to me the most interesting sports person I've run across in a long time. And one of the reasons is that he preaches what he calls the process. And the process is not just building a better athlete. It's also building a better person. And it's also building a stronger person mentally to be able to withstand the pressures that Alabama football is all about. But also it's a lifestyle regimen that when you leave Alabama, you hold yourself accountable in ways that I think very few college students and very few college athletes have an opportunity to experience. And that is at the heart of Alabama's success. And you can see it in the way they not only are they physically dominant, And you and Tom, you mentioned this great football player who's now coming to Alabama. He's being attracted by this idea of playing under this kind of system, a system within the system at Alabama. And just to go back to one other point,
yeah.
Nick Saban makes $5.5 million a year at Alabama, mm-hmm. and he is worth every single penny of that because he has altered that university not only as an academic institution, the kind of quality of students that they have, but he's tripled the athletic department's revenue overall since 2007 when he got there. And I spoke to the chancellor at the University of Alabama for a 60 Minutes piece that's upcoming in November on Saban. He said to us that Nick Saban is the single most important hire that the University of Alabama has ever made.
So,
and if that doesn't say something, I don't know what does.
I hear that, but you guys report other faces of this at the same time. I mean, on that front, you say Saban believed that if you invest honestly and truthfully invest in building a better person, whether it's Wes Neighbors or stars like McCarron or Amari Cooper, you end up with athletes who in times of intense stress embrace the moment rather than run for it. And the suggestion there is who are going to be better people for life. But how, you know, what percentage of the experience of college football players is like that, Armin, Jeff? And, you know, you're talking about what it's done for Alabama, but what percentage of big time college programs are net gainers for their schools? However you want to calculate that.
Well, I think to add on to what Armin said, it isn't just Alabama. You know, in fairness, a lot of what we've talked about today has mm-hmm. kind of been what I'll call the negative side of the game. But another school we spent an enormous amount of time with is Brigham Young University, another school that's very much focused and has a head coach, Bronco Mendenhall, that's very focused on building men, not just building football players. I was at the Virginia BYU game 2 weeks ago that was mentioned here in the opening to this program. And I was sitting in the press box with five NFL scouts. All five of them were there to watch one player, Kyle Van Noy, the BYU linebacker. He's the only player on the roster this year that will be a top draft pick in the NFL next year. There are roughly 100 other guys that are not going to play in the NFL. And I can tell you that the head coach, Bronco Mendenhall, and his staff are just as focused on those other 99 guys as they are on Kyle Van Noy because they know these guys are never going to play football past their BYU experience. And so I think, to be fair in the reporting and the presentation, mm-hmm. is that there are plenty of coaches and programs in the country who are focused on more than just winning games. But at the end of the day, we have to remember their job at the bottom line is to win games. And coaches who don't win are out of work. And so there's this constant tension that's on all of these guys
sure.
to win. We document a coach at Auburn who wins a national championship a couple years ago and then is fired because of a losing season. And so that's the kind of pressure these guys are under. There's no faculty, no university president who's under that kind of pressure.
I mean, you're right. 72 head football coaches fired between 2009 and 2012. At least 66 head football coaches earning over $1 million a year. And this, of the 120 football bowl subdivision FBS programs, only 20 of 120, only 22 break even or make a profit. The rest lose money. I mean, yeah, Armin, you're right about the upside, Armin, but I've also seen you quoted saying, I fear for college football. It's a runaway train.
Yeah, it is right now because of all the money that's pouring into it from so many different places, primarily from television. And then when you add in the pressure of a national football playoff, you know, you add another dimension. And to go back to your point, which I was going to get to, and I think it's a really important point, Tom, is that only about maybe 10 to 20% of these programs are actually net positive. But what's happened now on these college campuses, college football has become the front porch or the welcome mat to these universities. They are the bright shining light. And what's happening is this is a very large poker game. And if you want to play poker in the big time college programs, you have to have top facilities, you have to have a top stadium, you have to have a top coach, you have to have top academic advisors, you have to have this enormous umbrella of support staff in order to get into the game. And if you fail at it, that it's disastrous for a lot of these schools. Witness what happened at Tennessee. You can name four or five. Maryland, the same sort of thing that happened to those programs that went all in on college football and lost. But it still is, it's the only game in town that can literally almost overnight change the way your university is perceived. And that's what's behind all this the fuel to this runaway train is this is no longer about a sport. It's about how your university and how your brand is perceived nationwide.
Let's go to Ohio, Conneaut, Ohio, and Gary. Gary, thanks for calling.
Yeah, how you doing?
Okay.
My comment is basically these young athletes are just nothing but a bunch of piece of meats to these colleges. My son was 6'5". He won about 230.
Yeah.
We did the tour. He ended up in a Division III school. He was a little bit slow for a Division I. But there was only one school out of the bunch, and that was Cincinnati, where a coach said, look, you guys may think you're going to get into the pros. He said, 0.1% make it. He said, I was there. I was one game away when I blew my knee out. And he said, thank God my mother made me get my education. And he had his master's, and he was coaching again. But the problem is that there's so much money in this system, and it's so corrupt. I mean, Ohio has a coach at Ohio State making $5 million. I'm in the poorest school district system in Ashtabula County, where Conneaut is. And every time a teacher says, you know, we need money, they haven't had real raises for almost 5 years.
Yeah.
And they're going, well, you make too much money. But they're all gung-ho to build stadiums. They're all gung-ho to pay these guys $5 million. Something is wrong, and it's basically, you know, the mentality just drives me out of my mind.
Gary, I really appreciate your call from Ohio. Hey, Jeff, how about it? I mean, there's still this fear that we've got this big spectacle going on. It's a runaway train, as Armin says, and somehow it represents, despite all the beautiful athleticism and the care that is in corners of it, as you point out, it represents something gone awry in our culture.
Well, Tom, I don't disagree with anything that caller from Ohio just said, but I'll go back to this. I think when you look at the system, you have to get up high to see the whole perspective. And one of the guys that we follow through our book is mm-hmm. this kid, Kyle Van Noy at BYU. And
yeah.
He's just one illustration, and there are many in the book, who's a kid who is plucked out of a tough situation by a football coach, and he isn't a piece of meat. In fact, the coach made him sit out a year because he'd been arrested in high school. And most kids, you'd think, would say, well, I'll just go to another school and play. And this kid stuck it out. He followed very strict rules because he believed that this coach cared about him more as a boy and a future man than as a piece of meat or a football player. And that actually turned out to be true. 4 years later, he's the best linebacker in the country, and he's had 4 years of education. He's going to graduate with a degree. He's a smart kid. His life is different. And I just think there are lots of stories like that are out there. And to be fair in all this, you have to mention those in conjunction with all this other stuff that we're talking about.
No, it's all there. We're trying to add it up. I mean, Armin, you write about the boosters. They are so big. T. Boone Pickens, of course, huge in Oklahoma State. And this new reporting out of there about the payments made by coaches and boosters, sort of performance-based, to tackle a sack this much, that much. T. Boone Pickens reportedly put something like $500 million into Oklahoma State. What's the payoff for these boosters who are all over the place in the system?
Well, I'll let Jeff talk about T. Boone because he spent the weekend with him, which was just fabulous when he called me up and goes, guess who's going to be in the book? And I'm like, who? He goes, T. Boone Pickens. And I'm like, and this is part of it, Tom, the part of doing this book with Jeff, and just for a moment to talk about that.
Yeah.
We're better friends after doing this book than we were, and we were very good friends going in, and that often doesn't happen in these kind of collaborations. And
yeah.
He'd call me up and go, you're not going to believe who's going to talk to us. And I would go, no way. And then I would say, oh, guess who's going to talk to us? Bobby DiGeronimo from Ohio State. And so, yes, the boosters are huge, and we really wanted to build a chapter around the boosters and their influence. And their influence comes in many, many ways, whether it's picking the head coach or whether it's part of a network of guys who get together silently to help the coach do whatever has to be done, allowing the coach plausible deniability. But Boone is in Jeff's corner, so I'll let him talk about Boone.
And $500 million to Oklahoma State. The stadium's named after him where the Cowboys play. What's he get out of it, Jeff? We just got a minute here.
Yeah, what he gets out of it is that first you got to say this, because nobody ever mentions this. Boone has given more money to the academic side of the university than he has to the football team.
Okay.
So when you add up all, nobody ever mentions how many professorships he's funded, how many chemistry mm-hmm. departments he's funded, how many academic buildings he's built. The only thing he ever gets credit for is he built a football stadium.
Is he unusual in that as a booster?
Yeah, I don't know. I think Boone's unusual just as it is.
Period,
I mean,
yeah.
He's a very unusual guy. I mean, he flies in his own jet plane to the games, and I got to do that with him and see how he operates. But this is not a guy who needs, you know, needs power and fame. He's done all that. He's trying to give something back to the school that he got his education at, and he's had a huge impact on turning that university around. And I'm not just talking about the football program, but the university.
He's in the middle of a mess now, all these allegations about payments and so on there.
Well, he's not in the middle of a mess.
None of this touched Boone.
I mean, that's one of the things we mentioned.
Absolutely innocent in this.
His name is on the stadium.
His name's on the
stadium.
Well,
that's a different that's a different set of stones, Tom.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, you can't throw a guy into a mess when one of the points we make in the book is that he was asked to funnel a slush fund, and he said, no way, you'll get in trouble for stuff like that.
There is a level of intimacy here with everything going on behind the scenes that I've never quite read before. It's really terrific. The book is The System by Jeff Benedict and Armin Katayan. Grateful to both of you for being with us today. Thank you very much for joining us. Armin, Jeff, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Tom.
There it is, ladies and gentlemen. Listen, tune in tomorrow. Billy Crystal will be with us in this hour, talking about a life in comedy and just being Billy Crystal. Join us then. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We've got a little Alabama fight song here. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.